Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In the year 2025, if man is still alive, if a woman can survive, they may find.
Welcome, traveler from 2024. You just came from the hottest year humans ever lived. For 16 consecutive months, from June 2023 to September 24, the global mean temperature exceeded anything recorded before, and often by a wide margin, according to the World Meteorological Organization. You don't need to be a weatherman to know what is coming. You don't need AI. We have the science. This planet will get hotter and hotter. Ice is leaving the earth from the poles, tall mountains, and the sea. The rising darker ocean embraces more solar energy. An era of disasters arrives and stays until some thousands of years later, a new order is established. Earth returns to its hothouse state that dominates time on this planet. Here in human microtime, another year begins. For the next storms, floods, and fires, only a few numbers matter. Greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. The players are important, the amounts are critical, but a new devil appears, the rate of change. From biological systems to ocean currents, new science finds again and again, the rate of change is as important as the amount. 2024 is on track to be the warmest year on record, with global temperatures reaching 1.54 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, according to the WMO. But that organization calls this warming temporary, likely due to the previous El Niño, we will see. 2024 is thought to be 0.1 degrees C hotter than the previous hottest year, 2023. If that is confirmed, warming at 0.1 degrees C per year would heat Earth by 2.5 degrees C over pre-industrial by 2035. At that rate, we might reach civilization-ending heat of 3 degrees C by 2040, meaning collapse, global collapse, in just 15 years. Humans must attack the rate of warming for organized society to survive. Antarctic sea ice is at its second lowest on record. 2023 was the lowest. That means the reflective solar shield of ice around the poles is becoming substantially smaller. The darker ocean is absorbing the extra energy. You know from the news, if not from your own life, that extreme weather events are getting worse. The hurricanes, the typhoons, the wildfires, freak flash floods, and creeping drought are too hard to miss. Oceans are record hot, especially in the North Atlantic. We covered a lot of this on this program. Check out our free archive at ecoshock.org to hear what the scientists say. Let's get straight to the drivers, the greenhouse gases. The best known is carbon dioxide. Around two-thirds of warming comes from CO2, measured as parts per million in the atmosphere. The carbon dioxide level at the Mauna Loa Observatory is around 425 parts per million as of December 2024. CO2 concentrations have increased 11.4% in just 20 years, according to the World Meteorological Organization. Let's pay attention to that critical growth rate. According to NOAA, CO2 levels in November 2023 were 420 parts per million and 423 parts per million in November 2024. The difference comes to 3.39 parts per million higher in 1 year. Growth rate in 1975 was 1.23 parts per million, almost a third less. In the year 2000, CO2 increase was still only 1.25. parts per million. But that was a lower year when the increase was bouncing between 1.5 parts per million and 2.3 parts per million until 2010. Growth rate was 2.79 in 2023, according to NOAA. Now it is 3.3.
Mighty methane.
The second major warming gas, though, that we have to talk about is methane. It's a single carbon atom surrounded by four atoms of hydrogen. In 2024, methane levels in the atmosphere are rising at a faster rate than any other major greenhouse gas. According to NOAA, in August 2023, methane averaged 1,917 parts per billion in the atmosphere. By 2024, that was 1,926 parts per billion, an increase of 9 parts per billion in 1 year. And that covers a lot of the global atmosphere. The methane growth rate per year varies widely over time. For example, it was 14 parts per billion in 1991, but that was because of a great cloud of methane released in the huge Pinatubo volcanic eruption in the Philippines that year. Then methane levels decreased up to about 7 parts per billion by 1993. And from the year 2000 to 2006, methane growth was kind of muted and some experts stopped worrying about it. Then around 2007, this highly potent greenhouse gas began climbing again, the rate increasing from 5 to 7 parts per billion per year. By 2014, methane increase hit double digits of 10 to 12, and then a 15 parts per billion in 2020, 17 in 2021, and slumping slightly in 2023. Remember, we're not talking about the amount of methane in the atmosphere directly, but the rate, the key rate of the increase. Let's go to the third big one. It's nitrous oxide, and that is where too much of climate reporting stops. So they talk about carbon dioxide, maybe methane, but there are far more greenhouse gases rising into the air from human activities. We can't lose sight of this in a focus on carbon dioxide. Although estimates differ slightly, nitrogen oxide is responsible for about 10% of net global warming since the Industrial Revolution. It's also the top ozone-depleting substance still being released into the atmosphere, and that's important. 65% of nitrogen oxide emissions come from human activities. Nitrous oxide has a global warming potential of around 280 times greater than CO2, and once it's up there, NO2 stays in the atmosphere for over 100 years. Nitrous oxide emissions have accelerated greatly in the last 40 years. From 1980 to 2020, emissions increased by 40%. We didn't see it coming. This dramatic increase in nitrous oxide in the atmosphere is greater than all the climate models predicted. NOAA says the annual increase measured for nitrous oxide during 2020, 21, and 22 are among the fastest recorded since measurements began, end quote. Nitrous oxide wafts into the atmosphere from the use of fertilizers made from natural gas, of course. Nitrous oxide is also known as a byproduct of burning all fossil fuels. Oil, gas, and coal, whenever you burn them, nitrous oxide is one of the things that comes out. Poor wastewater management adds more nitrous oxide to the air, too. But there are other rare but extremely potent human-made gases like hexafluorethane and sulfur hexafluoride, and they're rising at increasing rates. These super greenhouse gases come mainly from petrochemical processes and chemical manufacturing. They could be controlled by regulations and international agreements, but so far are not. According to climate.gov from the U.S., the annual greenhouse gas index is a measure that tracks the global warming influence of all human-emitted greenhouse gases, which was 51% higher in 2023 than it was in 1990. But the government figures and science reports simply leave out the single largest gas retaining heat on this planet, water vapor. We know that for every degree of warming, the atmosphere can hold 7% more water vapor, which is about 2 to 3 times more potent in warming than carbon dioxide. The annual greenhouse gas index does not include it. And that has been because water vapor is considered to come and go quickly, often within weeks, and actual amounts in the atmosphere can vary over time. Still, with a proven hotter atmosphere driven by human activity, we can now consider the increase in water vapor in the air as permanent. It should be added to our carbon dioxide equivalent to get the real atmosphere warming gas total, and it should be included in the rates of increase. We are not getting the full picture, despite increasing obvious climate impacts. Humans always give themselves a loophole, don't we? A special exception for us, from the laws of physics and living things. So, what do all these numbers mean? The rate of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are increasing at alarming rates higher than official predictions. We are still lying to ourselves about how fast this is getting worse. Just as a new climate denial and backpedaling mechanism takes over in many countries and in corporate boardrooms, humans are abandoning some of their weakest attempts to protect ourselves and coming generations from a catastrophic climate shift. We have to fight that off at least. Slightly on the positive side, solar installations are increasing around the world, that's for sure, and especially in the developing world. Some economies may truly leapfrog past dependency on fossil fuels. Electric vehicles are starting to dominate new vehicle sales in some parts of the world. However, all the added renewable energy is soaking up some of the increase in energy demand only, as more of the world enters a digital industrial state. We are producing more fossil fuels than ever. That's the reality. Remember all the talk about coal being on the way out? Well, according to a new report published December 2024 from the International Energy Agency, coal burning has reached a new record peak and is expected to remain there for years. China alone burns 30% more coal than the rest of the world combined. This is very disturbing news. It's bleak and it's black. Worse, just as the world needs to slash energy demand with heat pumps and efficiency and reduced consumption, all that stuff, along comes a new technology that eats fossil fuels. Artificial intelligence is sweeping the world. I produce new images for each Radio EcoShock show with AI. According to brand new research, each of my attempts at an image uses as much energy as charging a cell phone. Every image. As you know, the biggest AI producers and servers are rushing to nail down major energy sources. Microsoft plans to reopen the fatally flawed Three Mile Island reactors to power their AI. These are the same designs that blew up in Japan. Not a good idea. A coal utility in Nebraska was going to close, but now that stays open for AI, including Google. Even if AI decides on using renewable sources, that sucks up the limited market for renewables and other human needs like heating and cooling and lights. Is the arrival of energy-sucking AI at the very time of critical need for reductions just bad luck in human affairs? Or is it a natural outcropping of a fossil fuel society with no regard for other living things and the future? Either way, the verdict is the critical next 10 years to slash emissions before irreversible tipping points looks doomed at the outset. ...2024 may be the hottest year you ever lived and the coolest year you will ever experience. With possible exceptions, every year from here on out may be the hottest and coolest for all of us and all life. Until something in human production breaks, collapses, or a miracle revolution comes. There were very dark times in the last century, and they ended. Human existence has been temporary ever since, as nuclear mutual annihilation hovers over us. But wars and bombs are still under human control. We can start them, and we can end them. Climate change, we can only start. Once the great warming starts, nature takes over with giant feedback loops like thawing permafrost and vanishing glaciers. Warming becomes its own thousand-year Reich, with humans helpless to stop it. Of course, we have illusions of saving ourselves with machines. We investigate that next.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
We turn to machines, begging on our knees, artificial savior. When will you save us? Oh, Deus Ex Machina.
The great hope is called direct air capture. International agencies already count DAC, as it's called, among solutions after overshooting the 1.5 degree safety mark. Two carbon capture plants are starting operations in Iceland, but how real is it? If anybody knows, it is Howard J. Herzog. He is a senior research engineer in the MIT Energy Initiative. Herzog is an expert in the field with many papers published about DAC. Now, with three other senior and principal researcher scientists at MIT, Herzog published a startling conclusion in a commentary titled, Getting Real About Capturing Carbon from the Air. From the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Howard Herzog, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Right. So if I want to build something or go anywhere or do much of anything, I just need the right machine. Machines seem to solve everything. Can we call direct air capture a machine? How does it work?
Well, it is a machine or a couple of machines. I call it more of a process that where you air comes in to your facility and then leaves with the CO2 taking out of it. And it's basically done in two steps. The first step is something that absorbs the CO2 from the air onto some sort of sorbent, which is some sort of chemical. It grabs the CO2 out of the air. And then in the second step, you release that CO2 and capture it so you have highly concentrated CO2 that you can then, in general, what you would do is put it in deep geologic formations. Some people are also trying to use it in different ways, but the uses for that CO2 are fairly small, and the capacity to put it underground is quite large.
So in whatever planning we allegedly have, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the COP mechanism, the governments, the private corporations, are they counting on direct air capture of carbon dioxide in our future plans?
So groups like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change summarize the literature and write these assessment reports, and they feed into the climate negotiations, and they are looked at by policymakers. So they look at what's in the literature, and you have a lot of groups around the world. I don't know the exact number, maybe around 20 major ones that do these energy economic evaluations, look at our emissions and our economics running out to the end of the century, and they look at different scenarios. And in the past 5 years or so, what we call negative emissions, or taking CO2 out of the atmosphere, it has creeped into these models and therefore is being reported by the IPCC. In fact, to meet the targets, whether it's 1.5 degrees C or 2 degrees C stabilization, because we are not reducing our emissions great enough, it looks like we're going to overshoot it. So most of these scenarios that we look at overshoot our target and need to come down by taking CO2 out of the air. The way to do that, there's a whole bunch of ways, some biological, some chemical, to do that. But recently, what's called direct air capture has sort of become a hot topic. And one reason is things that take CO2 out of the air, like planting trees. Well, that's nice, but what happens 10 or 20 years down the road if the forest burns down or there's a pestilence and the trees die? It's not that permanent. What you see from direct air capture is what people look at as a really high-quality carbon removal credit. You can measure it. You can actually see the CO2 you take out of the air. It's immediate, and storing it in geological formations is essentially a permanent solution of keeping it out of the atmosphere.
How far has the industry progressed?
you can go back in the literature and see some of the first references to direct air capture and sort of the way it's being implemented today, going back to around the year 2000 or so. So it's been around 25 years, but it's only been in the past, what I would say, less than 10 years that it's really being looked at seriously with significant investment going into the field. And what we see today are several pilot plants, but on the scope of things, these pilot plants are small. So we're putting out, the world's putting out, I forget the exact number, 40, 50 billion tons of CO2 or CO2 equivalent a year of greenhouse gases. And to really operate on that scale, you need to be operating at the billion ton a year level. Right now, the biggest direct air capture plant in operation is 4,000 tons a year, and that's up in Iceland by a company called Climeworks. Oxy, the oil company down in Texas, is constructing a plant that will become the world's biggest if it goes online. It's supposed to go online mid-next year. That would be 250,000 tons a year. So we see some examples of this out there, but they're at a very, very small level compared to what we have to do to really scale up the technology to have an impact on climate change.
Yes, I looked into the DAC plant, the Mammoth plant it's called, in Iceland, operated by Climeworks. They just opened part of the new facility in May 2024. The nameplate capacity for carbon capture is 36,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide a year. Just back of envelope calculations on my part finds we would need about a million of those to even stay with current emissions. Talk to us about the problems of scale when actually trying to build our way out of carbon overshoot.
Let me first say there are other methods, and there's certain pathways that I think are more promising than direct air capture for doing it. I think all the methods can make some sort of contribution doing it, but one of the biggest barriers for direct air capture itself is the amount of energy it needs to take the CO2 out of the air. It's fairly energy intensive. If it was next to a power plant, a coal-fired power plant, and that coal-fired power plant was feeding the electricity into the direct air capture plant, for every molecule of CO2 taken out of the air by the direct air capture plant, the coal plant will put up 1.2 molecules of CO2, which, of course, does us no good. So you really need low-carbon energy to run these things. Unfortunately, we don't have enough low-carbon energy today to do everything that we want. We still have a lot of oil and gas in our electricity production system. We want to increase our low-carbon energy to fuel our electric vehicles. We need it to power our heat pumps. People talk about green hydrogen. You need electricity for that, or carbon-free electricity for that. So there's a lot of uses for this. So that's one barrier to scaling it up. And the other barrier, which, you know, was a main thrust of the article we wrote, was the cost of doing this.
Yes, one DAC design requires a giant concrete and steel structure 3 stories high, 3 miles long. You wonder if these machines can even overcome the carbon used in their construction and operation and maintenance.
Well, at this point, that is, you know, the life cycle is an issue on that. You know, if for, say, 30 or 40 years in the future and we've really decarbonized our energy system, then those materials will be also become decarbonized. But today, finding carbon-free energy to run the plant and also to make the materials needed by the plant is the problem. And all of this traces back. The real challenge is the low concentration of carbon dioxide in the air. So even though from climate reasons we have too much carbon dioxide in the air from a chemical process, it's very, very small. It's about, 420 ppm today, or 0.042%. And that makes it difficult, not only difficult to remove, but you need to process a lot of air just to grab one ton. So to get thousands of tons or millions of tons and then up to billions of tons, that's a lot of air to process And that takes big machines and lots of energy.
And you found studies that may be used in government planning with unrealistic projections for both the cost per ton and the total CO2 capture that could be expected from DAC. Do you want to tell us about this disconnect, particularly the cost per ton angle?
Yes. So, as we say, Climeworks, which has a plant operating in Iceland and a second plant that you mentioned, the Mammoth plant, coming online, actually go to their website, and as an individual, you can buy carbon credits from them. The cost of those carbon credits, they don't talk about in dollars per ton, but it's an easy conversion to make, is $1,500 per ton of CO2, which is very large. A lot of high-tech companies and, say, airline companies are trying to buy credits, and even though a lot of these numbers aren't public, it seems like the numbers they're paying are the high $100 per ton, approaching $1,000 per ton. This is very expensive when you look at the price in the European emissions trading system. Their numbers are about $100 a ton to keep CO2 out of the atmosphere. So when you're talking on the order of $1,000 a ton, it's very expensive. And, you know, is that really sustainable to pay it? So you got to get the numbers down. And so people, of course, you know, these companies are pitching to industry and they say, we can get the cost down. And they absolutely can get the cost down. But the question is, how far can they get the cost down? And a lot of them are saying we get down to even $100 a ton. And the U.S. DOE has a target of $100 a ton for carbon removal from all the different various methods. And that number is sort of stuck, you know. So you see a lot in the range of $100 to $300. But from our engineering analysis, based on how much air you have to capture, how much energy you need to use, and all of this, we just find that unrealistic. How far they can get down, anybody's guess. I made a guess in an article I wrote a couple years ago saying maybe by 2030 we can get to $600 to $1,000 range. People say I'm way too conservative. They're more bullish than that. But I say let's wait and see. I haven't seen any evidence to make me revise my thing. And I'll tell you how some of these things work. So people say, okay, there's something called learning by doing, and it's fairly well established that as a technology matures and you learn by doing, the price will come down. So you have a price today, and you keep doing it, and price comes down. The problem is we're so early in direct air capture that we don't know what the real price is today. And, in fact, a lot of times projects that are in the early stage, prices increase. So one problem with direct air capture, you got to harden it to the weather. Well, a lot of times in the laboratory you're doing cost estimates, you sort of ignore that. But then when you go out in the field, okay, now I got to add this cost. So lots of costs get added. So we don't know what the cost is today. And secondly, we don't know how fast that cost will come down. And what people do on learning curve, they assume, all right, I'm going to sell so much quantity and the price will come down so much percent. But I would claim that that's a fairly empirical thing. We've seen curves from, say, solar energy and the like, but that doesn't mean that same curve is going to apply here. So what they'll do, and I've seen several papers on this, they'll say, okay, here's the price today. It's going to come down, and the price will end up here. Well, you know, theoretically, all right, but in reality, I don't believe it. And the other thing is they don't take the constraints into the model. There's minimum energy you're going to need. There's minimum amount of steel and concrete you're going to need. And we don't know all those prices. So we don't, you know, I get into debates with people. What's the price of carbon-free electricity in 2050? No one really knows. And people say, well, look at the solar and wind so cheap today, you can get it for this and this. But yet, while we have cheap solar and wind, electricity prices in aggregate go up because solar and wind are intermittent, and the electricity we want to use for most of our things, including the direct air capture plants, have to be 24/7.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host,